loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio with my co-host, John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big issues. First, political turmoil has rocked Lebanon and Saudi Arabia in recent days as the Lebanese prime minister resigned while he was in Saudi Arabia, and a sweeping purge eliminates rivals inside the royal family of Saudi Arabia. Then, Donald Trump is headed to South Korea following his meetings with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on one of the most anticipated stops of his Asia tour. Will Trump continue to press for confrontation? And finally, a flurry of U.S. airstrikes near the Afghan city of Kunduz has caused heavy civilian casualties, according to Afghan government officials. The Trump administration's new strategy for the Afghan war is proving to be even deadlier than before.
But first, we turn to Lebanon and Saudi Arabia. Political turmoil has rocked Lebanon and Saudi Arabia in recent days as Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri resigned while he was in Saudi Arabia, and a sweeping purge eliminates rivals to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. We're joined from Beirut by Jana Nakhal. She is an independent researcher and a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. Jana, welcome. Thanks for coming back and speaking with us.
Hello, thank you.
So there have been so many serious developments in the Middle East just in the last few days, especially in Saudi Arabia and Lebanon. Saad al-Hariri was visiting Riyadh when he suddenly resigned on Saudi television. And more interestingly, he blamed Hezbollah, saying that there was an imminent threat to his life, and the only way he could save himself was to resign as Prime Minister of Lebanon. Tell us, what is happening over there?
Everybody's surprised, including the parliament, including the head of the parliament, including Hariri's allies and members of the party. Nobody expected this to happen. Nothing in Lebanon actually indicated that this is happening. Within the meetings for the government were going in the right way. People were preparing for the elections, actually. And even his allies and his own party were preparing for the elections. But then suddenly this happened. And if you see today's Al-Akhbar, the main newspaper in Lebanon, it had a picture, a huge picture of him calling him Al-Rahina, so the hostage. We don't know what's going on. We don't know where he is. And there's a lot of rumors that he could be arrested along with the other Saudi princes, specifically that Hariri has a Saudi identity.
Yes, he has a Saudi nationality, a Saudi passport. So let's put all of this into perspective. We've got what many observers are calling this, calling a soft coup in Saudi Arabia. We have dozens of princes, of ministers, former ministers, businessmen, court officials, all being arrested and being held at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, which is a very typically Saudi thing to do. You've got a mysterious helicopter crash where the son of a former crown prince was killed mysteriously, along with seven or eight other people. You have the Lebanese prime minister arriving in Saudi Arabia, going on national television, Saudi television, and resigning, saying that his life is being threatened by Hezbollah. Hezbollah apparently was taken completely by surprise. They say that they have no idea what he's talking about. And of course, he's perfectly welcome to return to Lebanon. What in the world is happening? Jana, is this all a concerted move by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to consolidate power in the kingdom while pointing the finger at the Iranians? Or am I looking too much into this? Is it just chaos?
No, no, not at all. You can also add that the Saudis called upon the Palestinian president today to visit and discuss the Palestinian issues, which also needs to be added to the whole image. So I definitely see it as a consolidation of the crown prince's coming into power. But then at the same time, you can link it to what's going on in Syria, where the whole fight in Syria has been, the direction of the fight has been changing.
Last week, Deir ez-Zor was taken. More is expected to be taken. And practically, we're talking about the situation where Hezbollah is gaining power and is gaining support. So whereas Hariri was caught to break his current alliance in a way with Hezbollah and the state, and the Lebanese government, I mean, this is a whole new, it's a change of the whole, let's say, regional portrayal of what's, I mean, our regional alliances, specifically that in Yemen, nothing is changing, and things need to be directed towards Iran more and more.
Let me read to you what some U.S.-based observers are saying. Madawi Rashid, who is a writer for the Middle East Eye, says, it is hard to see how a new hyper-modern, economically advanced kingdom is going to emerge out of backstabbing and purges conducted at the highest level. Bruce Rydell, a former senior CIA official and White House senior director at the National Security Council, said the kingdom is at a crossroads. Its economy has flatlined with low oil prices. The war in Yemen is a quagmire. The blockade of Qatar is a failure. Iranian influence is rampant in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq. And the succession is a question mark. It is the most volatile period in Saudi history in more than half a century. Would you agree with that? Is this a dangerous time for Saudi Arabia?
I totally agree with that. I mean, in these past two days, there was it was practically impossible for us to understand what's going on. People were just like throwing things around and saying, it might be this way, it might be that way, this might be happening. Nobody has expected this to happen. And at the same time, within the changes, to look at it as part of the changes that are going on within Saudi Arabia, you cannot expect anything. You can just like sit and wait and see what's going to happen.
And then, John and Jana, we have also what's going on with the big escalation in Yemen. The Saudi-led coalition says that the rocket that was fired, a ballistic missile at Riyadh, could constitute, quote, an act of war. The Saudis are now blockading the ports in Yemen. In other words,
in fact, there were 29 separate Saudi missile attacks on Sana'a last night.
All right. Yeah, that I did not know. So here we have we have chaos inside the kingdom, a transition that's marked by a huge purge. People are dying in helicopter crashes. There was the shooting of the former king's son.
Right. King Fahd's son, Abdulaziz, was mysteriously shot while resisting arrest today.
That was today. Where does it all end up? I mean, in other words, one of the things that could happen under these kind of conditions of chaos or dislocation, uncertainty, is that the Saudi leadership could transfer or divert attention into a larger scale conflict elsewhere. Do you think that's possible?
Actually, this is what they're trying to. I think that this is what they're trying to do, and they're trying to move the space of friction, let's call it, into Lebanon in different manners and in different ways. So we can call it like an it could be an indirect form of warfare. But still, it can also be a direct form of warfare where, up until now, media is. The Lebanese and Arab media is really being involved in this. There's a lot of talk about sectarian differences, so there is a certain sowing of sectarian sedition and differences. And so things are really happening very, very soon, and we don't think that anything is impossible, saying that even Israel, it's possible for Israel to attack also.
The Lebanese leadership, John, of Hezbollah has called for patience and calm in Lebanon. In other words,
how's that for role reversal?
Yeah. But that means the situation has to be very acute. And there's been a lot of talk, John, in the recent months that the Israelis could move again in Lebanon. They did in 2016. They succeeded in creating a lot of human misery, but they didn't succeed militarily. If anything, a military operation completely backfired. Talk about those possibilities, those prospects, and what might happen. What do you think the thinking is in Tel Aviv right now?
As much as I'm saying that everything is possible, but at the same time, if Saudi Arabia decides to have a war in Lebanon, they will be doing the proxy war for Israel. So why would Israel have the need to intervene, right? Because they're doing Israel's job. So it's easier to do it that way. But at the same time, we never know if they're planning some economic kind of blockade, definitely political paralysis. We're expecting also some forms of assassinations and bombings. And so the security situation in Lebanon is expected to be to get worse.
Brian, President Abbas, the Palestinian president, according to Haaretz, has already landed in Saudi Arabia, specifically to discuss Iran. They're calling this an unplanned visit. This thing seems to have so many different moving parts. And it seems to me that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is trying to do two things simultaneously. He's trying to solidify his own position as Crown Prince because he's frankly unpopular among other royal family members. His elevation to the role of Crown Prince was far from unanimous, and a very, very popular prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, who had been Crown Prince, was deposed. I can tell you, Mohammed bin Nayef was the most popular Saudi prince in the United States, right? Americans loved him. The White House, the CIA, the Defense Department, the State Department, everybody loved Mohammed bin Nayef, who had made his career in the intelligence services. But Mohammed bin Salman is an unknown. He's young, he's brash. And so one component of this is that he's trying to either arrest or expel anybody who could possibly pose a threat to him. That's one thing. The second thing is Iran. I think the Saudis have an obsession with Iran. I understand that Iran and Saudi Arabia are traditional enemies. Sure. I mean, every country has traditional enemies, but this is almost irrational. They're fighting Iran in a proxy war in Yemen. They're trying to provoke something, I think, in Lebanon. And we see this with the resignation of Hariri. And now Abbas is landing in Saudi Arabia on an unplanned visit to discuss Iran.
You would think the Palestinians have enough to discuss.
Right. The Palestinians, they don't have enough problems. They need to take on Saudi problems with Iran. Jana, do you think that the Saudis have the wherewithal to handle these two problems that they have created for themselves simultaneously? Can they handle both of these at the same time?
I think they're able to do it because the way they're doing it is just to create problems and create break ties between people and between countries. Because as much as I see Abbas being called into Riyadh is to really discuss the improved ties between Iran and Hamas. So really severing all these ties between the different countries and Iran, and so like isolating Iran, but at the same time isolating its allies in the region. So isolating Hezbollah in Lebanon, destabilizing Lebanon. Already Syria has been destabilized, and also mainly excluding Hezbollah from having a representation in the Lebanese state.
Yeah, you know, this is an ongoing theme. Jana's right. So many governments in the region, plus the United States, just can't accept the fact that Hezbollah is a legitimate political party in Lebanon and is a part of the government.
But there, in this case, if John is right, there's now an effort underway to sort of knock Hezbollah off the perch, because
yes,
obviously it's been an ascendant political party, and especially because of its role as the resistance in the 2006 Israeli aggression against Lebanon. There's another factor here which we want to bring into play, which is how the Saudis and the Saudi transitional leadership is viewing its ties to Washington, because Washington, the Trump administration, is loaded up with anti-Iran hawks and also anti-Hezbollah hawks. In other words, these are the people who are trying to sabotage the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal, with the hope that there could be a new sort of realignment of forces in the Middle East, because they believe that Obama weakened the position of the United States and the position of the Saudis by trying to have some sort of modicum, some sort of an agreement with Iran. Could it be that the Saudis have fine-tuned the current chaos to play well here in Washington? What do you think about that, Jana?
I think that they're trying. So first of all, you were talking about bin Nayef, who was extremely popular. And so the new conference is one way or another, not only clearing his way, but also trying to prove that he's even better than Ben Naif towards the American government, towards the American state. And so I think that this whole thing can be read through a new form, or like they're trying to make a new regional order in which Iran is isolated, and in which each and every country there is a stronger ally to KSA. Hariri has proven himself not to be a strong ally, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And you know, another thing that many observers are forgetting is that when King Salman announced that his son, Mohammed bin Salman, would become crown prince and that Mohammed bin Naif would step down, that Mohammed bin Naif was placed under house arrest. And he's still under house arrest in his own home. So again, anybody who could possibly pose a threat to Mohammed bin Salman is out. Another thing, too, in this purge that began yesterday, Prince Mitab bin Abdullah, the son of the former king, King Abdullah, and the very longtime head of the Saudi National Guard, was among those arrested. And he's currently being held at the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh. This is a guy who controls the organization, the Saudi Arabian National Guard, that is single-handedly responsible for internal security, including the security of the royal family. So this is a way for Mohammed bin Salman to put his own people, in literally every different component of internal and external security in the kingdom.
And I think it's also a way of breaking the ties that were built in the older system, let's say.
Yes.
He's trying to create a whole new system for him to come into power. So whoever is going to be in power is going to be put by him, not by the traditional ways in which things were happening before.
Well, let's help the audience over here, which won't understand how the traditional ways did work. Just explain how it did work and what the difference is now.
So there's an important component in the Saudi system, let's call it, which is the connection between the royal family and the tribes, the different tribes. One of the anecdotes that is going around is that bin Salman did not even accept these conventions when his father wasn't even a king yet. So he had a totally different kind of a Western view into how things should happen, how the relationship with the king himself and the princes should take place. And so I think that this is being reproduced now, and that the connections and the kind of loyalty that is there between the family and the tribes is broken, and that the kind of clientelism between these two is totally being destroyed.
You know, that's really a very important point, because Saudi Arabia only exists as a country because all of the tribes agree to allow it to exist as a country, with the Al Saud family heading it. So if the tribes are unhappy, then everybody's unhappy. One other thing that's been overlooked, at least in the American press, is that a member of the bin Laden family has also been arrested. He's not a terrorist, bin Laden. He's the actual head of the bin Laden family of companies. Now, any Saudi observer will tell you that the bin Laden family is a very honorable, very old family, originally from Yemen. They've literally built the kingdom. The ports, the airports, the hospitals, the highways, everything has been built by the bin Laden family. And now the head of the bin Laden family is under arrest at the Ritz-Carlton. So this has the potential, I think, and I think probably Jana would agree with me, this has the potential to upset that balance with the tribes. And if you have elements of the royal family opposing these moves, and you have tribal leaders opposing these moves, things are not going to go smoothly. Saudi Arabia is likely headed for more trouble. Would you agree, Jana?
Exactly. I think he's doing the unthinkable. He's actually touching people that are not supposed to be touched politically. And so I'm very sure that there's a lot of instability going on between the tribes. But I'm also aware of the fact that things don't happen the way they happen in Lebanon, for instance. So you wouldn't expect people to go into the streets and demonstrate, because these are princes and tribes, right? So the way through which the tribes are going to refuse and object to this is yet to be discovered.
Jana, I have a historical question for you. In 1967, King Saud, who was the first king after the death of the founder of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz, was deposed by his brothers. He was mentally unbalanced. He was corrupt, and he was deposed and exiled. There were several princes, brothers and half-brothers, who then decided to flee to Egypt. They're called the Free Princes. And they were far more liberal in their outlook, and they were supporters of Arab nationalism. Are we seeing something akin to the Free Princes? Are we seeing Mohammed bin Salman trying to stamp out more progressive threats to the kingdom? Or is this strictly an internal family fight?
Let's agree that it's not progressive in any sense. So I think it's just, I don't know if this can happen like in the 60s, sorry, in the 70s. What I think is that, so the king is very much aware of what's going on and he agrees on it. And so how could things happen within these tribes and amongst these princes? Everything is open. But definitely this is not an attempt to reform. This is just an attempt to clear up the way for his own rule and to clear up the way to make sure that there's nobody who objects to whatever he's going to propose and that he would be the sole, practically king, yeah, the sole decider on what's going on in Saudi Arabia, which is incredibly linked to what the U.S. wants it to happen.
And isn't it interesting, Brian, that we're not really talking about the king right now, King Salman? I have a very close friend who was recently part of a delegation to Saudi Arabia. And he and about a dozen other people were sitting in the king's majlis, the comfortable room where the king receives delegations. And he told me that the king had an iPad on his lap, and a member of the American delegation would ask him a question. He would pause, he would look at the iPad, and then he would answer the question. Well, my friend noticed that at the end of the room was Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and he too had an iPad. So whenever an American would ask the king a question, Mohammed bin Salman would type the answer, his father would read it, and that was the king's response. So it was clear from the beginning that King Salman was not running the country. This young 32-year-old firebrand was running the country, and now he's making it more obvious. So what's next, especially in light of Hariri being in Saudi Arabia? Does Hariri go back to Lebanon? You know, his resignation has been refused. So technically, he's still the prime minister. Does he go back to Lebanon as prime minister and try to work through this issue with Hezbollah?
And John, before you answer that question, one additional question on top of it. Again, for our audience here in Washington, D.C., just talk on how the Lebanese government is structured. So how it would be that a succession to the current prime minister would take place.
Okay, let me start with what to be expected. We really do not know. We don't know if he's arrested, if he's free to come back, where he is. He's not answering his phone, so we don't know what's going on. The head of the parliament was in Egypt, and he flew back immediately after knowing this. We are waiting for his reply to what's going on. We expect, again, I'm going to highlight this, everything is open. Media warfare has started already. Sectarian tensions, Nasrallah's speech yesterday was obviously just calling people to calm down and not to go into the streets just because we don't know what's going on. And then, yeah, it's open to everything right now, including, of course, a military attack, a war. So whenever Hariri's resignation was accepted, there would be discussions amongst the parliament to decide upon who might be the upcoming prime minister. But not knowing what's going on with the current prime minister, his bloc actually cannot, I don't think his bloc will be able to have these discussions and to suggest a name for a future prime minister.
You know, and I think another interesting component here is the Iranians. And the Iranians have been silent, essentially. They've been silent. They've reported certainly that this purge of princes, but it's been just strictly factual. I think that the Iranians, which again is funny to me as an American, but it's the Iranians that are trying to keep things calm in the Gulf right now.
Exactly.
So where do we go next? Not necessarily in terms of internal Saudi family squabbles and purges, but again, you have Abbas landing in Riyadh. You have Hariri apparently wanting to return to his country. You have the Iranians waiting to see how this plays out. You have the war in Yemen forging ahead. So what should we expect?
I mean, for once, Syria is not the center of attention, which was the case for the past 6 or 5 years. Really, it seems like the mot de passe or the password is coming from Riyadh right now. So we, because nothing is, there's no natural or rational thing that called for this to happen. So they started the action. We need to know what they want to do next. But currently, the best thing to happen is really for for the Lebanese people, is just not to be answering sectarian calls and not to react to them.
Yeah, and again, we only have about 90 seconds left. Again, Jana, just for our 1 minute left for our American audience, just explain how the confessional system works in Lebanon and why something like this would stoke or potentially stoke sectarian dangers.
So first of all, just to clarify why people would see it weird that Hezbollah is part of the state. Actually, each and every political party in Lebanon is, except for the Lebanese Communist Party, is a political party that is linked to a sect, meaning Sunnis have a political party, Shia, Christians, etc., and Jews. So they are the representatives in the parliament. And so whenever Hariri resigned, he resigned because, quote unquote, he was objecting to Iran's meddling with the Lebanese politics, which was not clear in any sense, as much as others were meddling also through these political parties. I mean, they're all meddling equally. So now that Hezbollah is calling for this, for people to be peaceful and not to react emotionally about it, it's specifically because the Lebanese media and the Gulf media are calling for the Sunnis, who belong to Hariri's party or who support Hariri, calling them to go down into the streets or to object to what's going on, saying that it's the Shia who are currently controlling the country, and that the Sunnis need to have their own voice in the country.
Jana Nakhal, unfortunately, we're out of time. I wish we could have gone a whole hour on this fascinating subject. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Jana Nakhal. She's an independent researcher and member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Donald Trump is headed to South Korea following his meetings with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. On one of the most anticipated stops of his Asia tour, will Trump continue to press for confrontation with the DPRK? We are joined from London by Jude Woodward. She was London Mayor Ken Livingstone's advisor on culture and creative industries. And she is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Welcome back, Jude.
Thank you. Hi there.
Thank you for joining us. Trump said very defiantly again, the era of strategic patience is over regarding North Korea. He also is accompanied on this, quote, visit by three aircraft carriers, battle groups, and B-1B bombers, not a visitor bearing gifts, but a visitor bearing heavy-duty, high-tech weapons they're really weapons of mass destruction. What do we expect here, Jude?
Well, I think the most interesting thing on this is what Steve Bannon had to say. And remember, Steve Bannon is an ultra-Trump aggressive, foreign policy person. After he left the White House, he effectively said that this was all rubbish, that there was nothing that the US could do because all the military modelling suggests that whatever, if the US took military action against North Korea, yes, indeed, eventually it could flatten it, but not before something like 30,000 people a day were killed, a very high proportion of them in South Korea. And so actually, deterrence in a certain sense works, which is what the DPRK say in justification of their nuclear program, that the only thing that's stopping Trump carrying out this kind of destructive threat is the fact that they have the capacity to do a lot of damage in the region.
Brian, I can tell you from many years in the CIA that it's not as though nobody's ever thought of a military strike against North Korea. It's that they've considered military strikes against North Korea, and they have determined that they would not be effective, that they would likely lead to war. As Jude says, most of the casualties would likely be in South Korea. And so it's just not a workable strategy. You made a point just before we came on the air that a Pentagon official is saying that only a ground invasion could destroy the North Korean nuclear program. We're not equipped for a ground invasion, especially when we're bogged down in Afghanistan and Iraq and apparently most of the countries in Africa.
Yeah, and I think this military report, which is going right along the lines of what Jude is saying, is done to bolster those within the U.S. political establishment who are maybe worried about Donald Trump's rhetoric, because he said he sort of kneecapped his own Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and said, oh, Rex is doing a very great job. He's a nice guy, but he's wasting his and our time by trying to negotiate with Little Rocket Man. And at the same time, Trump, using the podium that at the United Nations General Assembly, said that he would, quote, was ready to totally destroy North Korea. I mean, is it all like bluster and bluff? Or, Jude, do you think there's actually a debate going on in Washington over the advisability of carrying out military action against the DPRK? What do you think?
Well, I'm sure that if Donald Trump could get advice from the Pentagon that they could carry out a military strike against North Korea, he would do it. His rhetoric indicates he's more than willing to undertake that kind of action, whatever the longer term consequences are, as long as it would be effective and not lead to a complete disintegration of US alliances in the region. And that's the problem, that it's all very well Trump would like to do that, but as I said in my first comment, the collateral damage to South Korea and possibly even to Japan is just too high risk. Plus the danger that both China and Russia might get involved. It's just too high risk, and that's the advice he's getting from the Pentagon. Of course there's a danger, because he's the commander-in-chief, and he could take some completely ill-advised action. But I don't think at the moment there's anything serious from inside the Pentagon. There may be from among the hawks he's appointed to his advisory team, but not from serious military figures.
John Kiriakou, I was interviewing Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff in the latter part of the first term of George W. Bush, here on this show on Loud and Clear. It was one of our first programs about 2 years ago. Because I had followed Iraq fairly closely, I'd been bringing medicine to Iraq in defiance of the sanctions. I knew, as anybody who was paying attention knew, that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction at that time. I mean, it wasn't like there was a big mistake. People knew it didn't exist. So I asked Wilkerson, why did the U.S. really invade Iraq? Why? If it wasn't weapons of mass destruction, the country was surrounded. It was humbled by and hobbled by economic sanctions. It couldn't really hurt anybody at that point. Why did you do it? Why did we, quote, America, do it? And he said, oh, it was the low-hanging fruit, meaning the United States could invade Iraq because it could invade Iraq without fear that Iraq could retaliate. And now you have Jude saying, well, North Korea can retaliate. North Korea can do a lot of damage. And that's the reason that the U.S. actually might not carry out an attack on North Korea. What's the message then to all countries like North Korea, or, right. I mean, what's the message?
The message is to develop a nuclear weapon. You know, I think that it's our rhetoric that's forcing countries to do this because it's us that they feel they need to be protected from. I think Larry Wilkerson is right. I find Larry Wilkerson to be one of the most astute observers of international politics. I think he's absolutely right. But I think that it's a fool's errand to think that North Korea would be low-hanging fruit just because it's something of an outcast country. I also think that Donald Trump has very seriously underestimated the power and the strength of China here. You know, the Chinese, we can complain about the Chinese as much as we want as Americans. But the fact of the matter is that the Chinese are truly averse to international military operations. And another point is that although it's not sexy and it's not quick, containment works. So we ought to be looking at a policy of containment, a policy of engagement with China, as well as South Korea and Japan, of course, and other regional powers, the Russians even, and, you know, diplomacy. We should get the North Koreans back to the table.
Jude Woodward, your book is called The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. John Kiriakou was talking about engagement and diplomacy as the way to go with China, but also with the DPRK. I'm looking at a Washington Post story. Again, this is on the eve of Donald Trump coming to China. And the headline is, a more hawkish Trump approach to China is coming soon. And then the first words of the article that's written by Josh Rogan, the Trump administration is slowly but surely coming around to a more hawkish, traditional Republican stance on China. Several signs of the shift will be evident, if not obvious, during the president's trip to Asia, but the real movement will play out in the weeks after President Trump returns home. And then the author goes on to quote numerous U.S. government officials, including people in the Rex Tillerson-led State Department, confirming this to be true. That seems to be sort of contrary to where things seemed to be going a few weeks ago, where Trump was saying, well, China's trying to help. Things are going good with China. Russia's not helping so much. Do you think things are about to get worse or more hawkish with China?
Well, I think that's always on the agenda. I think Trump, let's for a moment assume the guy understands what he's saying and isn't just talking out the back of his head. I think he understands the US cannot deal with every problem in the world at once. And therefore, has tried to, and China is very interested in not having a big fallout with the United States. Exactly as you said, it's not interested in military solutions to things. It wants its project coming out to the 19th Congress confirmed is still that its priority is economic growth, raising the GDP per head of the country, etc. That doesn't mean aggressive military policies. And Trump wanted China to sign up to the sanctions on North Korea. And China saw a deal that was in its interest, which was it went along with the sanctions on North Korea, which it was having problems with itself anyway, and this brought a quiet life with China. But if Trump decides that this isn't really the priority, then things will hot up. And from the point of view of hotting up, I would look at the situation in the South China Sea, which has gone sort of quiet over the last period of time. Whether Japan makes any further problems over the Jiayu or islands in the East China Sea, but particularly I think the hotspot is the South China Sea. Any further militarization of the South China Sea would cause a lot of problems in relations with China. And this new Indo-Pacific project, which Trump has put on the agenda, which is a sort of alternative to China's alliances and influence in Asia, to have a quadrilateral relationship of India, Japan, the US and Australia, the geographical pivot of such a set of strategic alliances is clearly the South China Sea. So I can envisage some hotting up of those kinds of problems.
Jude, can you tell me, how do the Chinese see this administration? How do they see American foreign policy right now? We see it as confused. Do they see anything more cynical than just confusion?
I think they have an acute judgment of what the Pentagon and the foreign policy establishment in China, in the US wants, irrespective of the words of Donald Trump and what he says on Twitter, which is they want to see China contained, they want to see China's economic rise slowed and preferably halted in order for it not to challenge the hegemony of the United States in the international arena. They understand that perfectly, but on the other hand, they're also good tacticians, and they understand that there are countervailing interests in the United States that can be played off. And offering concessions on trade or offering concessions on sanctions on North Korea or whatever the main issue is, as long as it doesn't cross what are red lines for China. But I think they think Donald Trump himself is just as confused as we think he is.
This article in the Washington Post says that Trump won't want to have any friction with Xi Jinping while he's there. That's obvious. He wants the trip to go smoothly. But there is, quote, a subtle but steady shift in the Trump administration's China approach is partially credited to the fact that Trump is filling his Asia policy team with China hawks inside the national security agencies and around the region. But John and Jude, we're really basically out of time. Both the Chinese Communist Party and the Workers' Party of the DPRK, no matter how much caricaturing one can do of these parties, they've been ruling parties for 70 years. They're mature ruling parties. They've gone through every twist and turn in U.S. Policy. And certainly the last thing anybody wants over there is an open confrontation with the United States, because even though no one may want war, wars happen, wars get out of hand, small conflicts become regional conflicts.
Yeah, nobody wins.
Nobody wins. We've been joined from London by Jude Woodward. She was London Mayor's Ken Livingston's advisor on cultural and creative industries. And she is the author of a new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A flurry of U.S. airstrikes near the Afghan city of Kunduz has caused heavy civilian casualties, according to Afghan government officials. The Trump administration's new strategy for the Afghan war is proving to be even deadlier than it was before. We're joined by Anne Wright. She's a retired United States Army colonel and former U.S. State Department diplomat in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war activist. Anne Wright, welcome to the show.
Good morning to both of you, Brian and John. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us again. And these strikes in Kunduz have killed as many as 60 civilians. This is, it seems to be at least, a real step up in the Trump administration's war in Afghanistan. And it seems like we just don't really care much about civilians. What's going on over there?
Well, indeed. I mean, we've never really cared much about civilians in all of these wars that we've had. And the use of these assassin drones, where the military tries to provide plausible denial of killing innocent civilians because they have great intel because of their drones that are circling 24 hours a day, actually, and looking at people. So they say, we only kill the people we want to kill. Well, the people they want to kill are innocent civilians, it looks like, because that's the majority of whom they kill. And the blowback of all of that is what is should be so worrisome to our U.S. military. Because if you look at the number of U.S. military that have been killed over the past 4 years, there have been more U.S. military killed by what they call blue on green, or the blue Afghan military outfits, uniforms, killing the green U.S. military. The people we're training, and that's supposedly the big mission of the United States for the last 11 years, has been training the Afghan national police and the national military. But when you have that group that you're training turning its weapons on the trainers and killing more than the Taliban have killed, then you ought to question why that is. And when you really start digging into it, it turns out that many of the people who have been captured alive after they've killed U.S. military have said, I killed them because they were killing my people in Afghanistan, along the Pakistani border generally, where most of the airstrikes have been, the drone strikes have been.
Brian, I remember less than 10 years ago, there was a situation in eastern Afghanistan where DynCorp was training Afghan regular army soldiers. And once the training was done, it took a matter of several weeks. One of the Afghans who had been trained slipped poison into a pot of stew and killed 17 of his former, or I'm sorry, 17 of his fellow soldiers. It turned out to be a Taliban plant. And it frankly was barely newsworthy in the United States because this kind of thing happens all the time. We're involved in a civil war in Afghanistan. A war in which we really have no horse, and all our presence does there is ends up with more and more death, causing more and more death, not just Afghans but U.S. soldiers as well.
Yeah, and it's very interesting what Anne Wright is discussing and talking about, where Afghan soldiers who are purportedly to be the allies, the trained supporters of the U.S. military, or vice versa. Actually turning against American troops. The same thing happened with the CIA, right, John? There was that incident where the CIA was recruiting somebody who
gained the
confidence of the CIA and blew a bunch of them up.
Indeed. The CIA had thought that it had recruited a man who purported to be Osama bin Laden's doctor in eastern Afghanistan. He agreed to meet with CIA officers at an encampment outside the village of Khost. About 10 years, well, not even that long, 6 or 7 years ago now, the CIA was so excited at the prospect of recruiting someone close to bin Laden that they didn't bother to follow regular security procedures. And indeed, this source mentioned that that it was his birthday the next day. And so the CIA officers baked him a cake. Now, when he got out of the Jeep, two security officers had gone to get him. When he got out of the Jeep and he was muttering to himself, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, that apparently didn't raise the suspicion of any of the CIA officers, and he walked into the CIA base and detonated a vest bomb, killed seven CIA officers, including two former colleagues of mine, two people with whom I worked very closely. But this is, you know, life in Afghanistan for the U.S. military and for the CIA.
And right, when the people feel that the war is against the people, the U.S. military is then encountered with what is called people's war, meaning everyone might actually be a combatant because the atrocities, the brutalities, the just indignity of being under foreign occupation is such that you never know who might turn against you. And then that leads the American forces, it seems to me, to adopt a policy or rules of engagement, which is basically, you know, shoot first, ask questions later, or drop bombs, ask questions later.
Well, that's right. And if you look really at the history of Afghanistan and of foreign involvement, and just going back just a little bit of time, you know, back to the 1980s, when the Russians got themselves immersed in the quagmire of Afghanistan, and the numbers of militia forces that were created, much of which was created by the United States, to go after the Soviet Union, those militia forces then turned on themselves in a civil war that was going on in the early 1990s, a brutal, brutal civil war that destroyed actually more of Kabul and the surrounding territory than the fight against the Soviet Union had done. And then it's those same militia forces that are still out there. And in fact, each one of the militia forces sends in to the Afghan National Police and Afghan military a certain number of people to get trained, to get retrained, to get some equipment, to get uniforms. And then at any time that the militia leaders, like the Haqqani Network or General Dostum or Atta or any of those guys, call their guys back from this training, they bring with them their weapons and their uniforms and then go back into the militias that will sometimes fight among themselves again, or go after the latest foreign invader and occupier, which is us, for God's sakes. So this is something that, it was incredible to me. And one of the reasons I volunteered to go on the small group to reopen the U.S. Embassy in Kabul in December of 2001 is I wanted to see what in the world the U.S. thought it could do. I mean, we all knew the history of the Soviet Union's invasion and occupation, and our initial cables back to Washington were saying, Washington, have a very limited time to do, if you want to help with education, help with health, things like that, you've got a limited amount of time because the history is any foreign invader is turned upon no matter what they think their good is. And that's exactly what's happened right now.
John Kiriakou, I want to ask you and Anne Wright. Anne has mentioned that she went to reopen the U.S. Embassy as a member of the State Department in December 2001. That would be a few months after the October 7th U.S./NATO invasion following the September 11th, 2001 attacks. What was it like in the end of 2001? Because here we are in 2017, the war continues to rage, longest U.S. war in American history. And John, because John, you were there too. What were the expectations at that time? Anne Wright was saying there was a limited amount of time, but did anybody envision at that time, either of you, that the U.S. would actually be fighting in Afghanistan with thousands of troops 16 years later?
Never in my worst nightmares. I think Anne would probably agree with me. I saw this. My colleagues saw this. In fact, we were told this, that this was a very limited operation, limited in intensity, limited in duration. The mission was to kill or capture Osama bin Laden and the senior al-Qaeda leadership, and to otherwise destroy al-Qaeda, which we did in just a few months. There was never any indication that this was going to be a never-ending war, that we were going to essentially de facto declare war on the Taliban, we were going to go after the Haqqani network, then we were going to go into Pakistan and start bombing the Pakistani Taliban or Pakistani separatist groups. There was never any indication of that at all. The mission was al-Qaeda. And the idea was that as soon as we destroyed al-Qaeda, we would come home.
And what were your impressions?
Well, the same thing, that it was to be a limited period of time. The issue of going after the Taliban, I mean, the Taliban kind of fled from Kabul and the major cities after the U.S. Came in. And then the various warlords, militias that signed on with the U.S. agenda at the time, you know, kind of took control. Then the U.S. helped set up an interim government, first with Karzai, and then he was formally elected by those people who could actually get to a polling place and vote. But the idea of the United States having a long-term military mission in Afghanistan was nothing that anyone ever talked about. And in fact, if you look at it, in the first 6 months that we were there, we could get no one in Washington to give us any attention on the issues of health, education, road building, things that might actually help the people of Afghanistan. Instead, we got silence, and it wasn't until really about 6 months into this that we finally, in Kabul, started realizing, Washington is focusing on something else, and that turned out to be the invasion of Iraq. And then all of focus went on to Iraq until about 2005 or 6, and then this pitiful little group that was left in Afghanistan, all of a sudden the Bush administration started bucking it up with more people, more armaments. And then the Obama administration really took it up to another level, all of which was kind of astounding to those of us who were in on the very initial part of reopening a U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
And the Trump administration has been very public and vocal about its desire to change U.S. policy and strategy in Afghanistan. In fact, it really hasn't, other than perhaps making it a little deadlier.
Trump says he wants to start winning.
Yeah, well, because nobody thought of that before.
Yeah.
And what do you think the end game is here? We can't kill everybody. So what is victory in Afghanistan? What does that look like?
I think it probably is like victory in Vietnam.
Right.
That you have to just kind of acknowledge that military operations do not resolve long-term challenges in countries that are internal challenges, not external. The issue of the Afghan Taliban, and I don't agree with their harsh tactics. I don't agree with their outlook on the world at all. But one has to recognize that they are a part of Afghan society, and the fact that the U.S. has torpedoed efforts both under the Karzai government and now under the Ashraf Ghani government, of the government trying to work out a peace deal with the Taliban. And the U.S. has undercut it at every turn. So I say leave it to the Afghans. And it may not be the society that American politicians want to see, but the Afghans are going to have to work this out again, as they have worked out things over the millennia. And I say it's time for us to stop killing them. Let them get on with the work they need to do and get our troops out of there.
Yeah, I think the U.S. actually killed the Taliban for a political leader who was most in favor of negotiations. Amazing that just torpedo negotiations in an endless war that cannot be won, as Anne Wright is saying.
And our allies in the Gulf have repeatedly offered to broker exactly those kinds of negotiations, the Qataris, the Emiratis, the Omanis, and we always walk away.
All right, we're out of time. We've been joined from Hawaii by Anne Wright. She is a retired United States Army colonel, former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan, a rare political figure because Anne Wright, as a matter of principle, actually resigned her position from the U.S. State Department in protest of George W. Bush's shock and awe invasion of Iraq. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.